Well, we're doing some studies every Sunday morning in the book of Exodus.
We're actually looking at a passage in chapter 16, which is on page 73 in the Bibles that are coming round. And as we're looking at this series of studies, it gives us this opportunity to kind of travel, really, with the Israelites. They're on this journey, well, what is to become quite an epic journey. I don't know whether they realised how epic it was going to be before they started it. But it's going to be a very significant journey with God. And the whole series is going under the title, Trust and Obey. Because that's what they're having to learn as they travel with God on this great journey. So what's going on? What's happening in the book of Exodus? Well, actually, I want to start just a little bit earlier in chapter 6, just with a few verses to get a bit of shape. That's on page 62. This is what Moses tells the Israelites right at the very beginning, before they set off, before actually anything had happened. It's what actually God had told him to say. And this, if you like, is God's agenda. This is God's kind of map of where they're going to go. Not physically, well, that's part of it, but in other ways too. So verse 6, this is what God tells Moses to say to the Israelites. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. That's the first thing. God says, I'm going to rescue you. You've been slaves for several hundred years. You've been shut up in Egypt, and I'm going to rescue you. I'm going to do some fantastic, mighty acts of judgment, and I'm going to release you. You're going to be freed. You're going to be set free. You're going to be rescued. Then he goes on, verse 7, and I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. That's part two of the agenda. He says, not only am I going to rescue you, but I'm going to bring you into this relationship with me. You're going to know me. I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. There's going to be this special relationship going on. That's the second thing. And then more than that, verse 8, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. That's the third thing. You're going to have a land, a homeland to live in. Rescue from slavery. Relationship with God. And if you want an R, real estate. That's not very good, is it? It's American. A land, somewhere to be your home in the future. And there's these three stages of what God is doing through Exodus and Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy in the Old Testament. He's rescuing his people, doing some fantastic, mighty acts. He's bringing them into relationship with himself, and he's taking them to give them this land where they can live. Three stages. And we've seen the rescue, the Passover, the Red Sea deliverance. We were thinking about that a couple of weeks ago. And God's mighty acts of judgment. And they're looking forward. They're on this journey to the promised land. I'm sure they've got that ringing in their ears. We've been rescued. We're on our way to the promised land. But in the middle of it, there's this relationship that needs to grow and needs to develop. And actually, in chapter 16, which you can go to now, which is on page 73, they're heading towards Sinai. God told Moses to bring the people back to the place where he met with God at the burning bush. Remember that in the early chapters of Exodus. And God says, look, bring them back here. And this is where the kind of relationship is going to be kind of sealed, as it were, as we, I think, may see in this series. So they're on their way there, but meantime, they're going on this bit of the journey. So today we're at the beginning of this middle section, this bit as they head towards this point where they have a relationship with God. That's where we are. In between, they're travelling. And as we shall see in a moment, what happens is that they're setting out on their journey from the Red Sea. They've been, do you remember last week, they were camped at Elim, there were lots of springs of water, having just had quite a difficult experience of getting to another place where the water was bitter. Remember, God provided a tree that would cleanse the water and they were able to drink it and so on. Now they're heading towards Sinai, where they're going to meet God. We saw last week, didn't we, that even in that celebration of chapter 15, there was also this tough time of bitter waters that they went through. Well, let's see what happens next. It's in verses 1 to 15 of Exodus 16. So here we go. Verse 1, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. And the Lord said to Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on other days. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, in the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us? And Moses also said, you will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You're not grumbling against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses told Aaron, say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And while Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. And that evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. We'll stop there and carry on a little bit later. So there's this problem, isn't there, between Elim, where they were, and Sinai, where they're heading to meet God. There's this desert smack in the way. And they run out of food. And as they run out of food, as they get hungry, as Carol was reminding us earlier, they start thinking about the food they used to have in Egypt. And they started thinking, well, Egypt wasn't so bad, was it? Well, sure, we had to do a bit of building. Sure that we had to make bricks without straw. And yeah, we were slaves. But at least we had huge pots of meat. And the word is cauldrons. You know, they've got this kind of memory of being able to sit around Egypt and have as much meat as they wanted. And here they are, smack in the desert, with nothing at all. Maybe they're exaggerating. Maybe their memories have been slightly affected by their hunger. Or maybe the Egyptian authorities, as it were, the empire, did provide them with food. I don't know whether you saw it. I saw a documentary on BBC a little while ago about how the great Egyptian kind of edifices were built. And there were these kind of communities, and it did look like food may have been provided at that time. But anyway, whatever, their memories are affected. And they grumble. And they grumble against Moses, and God speaks to Moses in verse 4. God responds. Now, it's a real issue for them, isn't it? It's very well for us to say, look, you know, bad people grumbling, what are they doing, why don't they trust God? I mean, put yourself in their position for a moment. They'd had this promise, they'd been rescued, they'd got this promise of a new land for them. God has said, you know, I've got good plans for you, and so on and so forth. They were thinking it was all going to be fine, and there they are. They can't even get to Sinai without food because there's this great desert in the way. And so they think, why? What's God been doing? God had been guiding them. He took them through the Red Sea. The pillar of fire was there in the nighttime, the cloud in the daytime. It was very clear that they should do. And yet, suddenly, there they were, no food. You can see it's a problem. Why this desert? Why didn't God let us die, they say. Why this? Why have we got to do this? And I don't know, maybe you've experienced that in your life. You feel as if God's been guiding you. He's made it clear. We're on this journey with him. But, you know, what about these deserts that we go through? What about these tough times? It's not, you know, difficult to act like the Israelites, is it, on those occasions? And maybe we need to remember that we've been rescued too, but we've been rescued into this relationship. There is this journey in which we travel with God. We have a promised land to come in the future. Heaven is real, and we're looking forward to that. But between now and then, we have this journey. And it will include deserts as well as great dramatic deliverances like the Red Sea parting. Do you see what I mean? So maybe we should be aware of that. Maybe like the Israelites, we get into circumstances that make us question things. Maybe we come with memories of our past, like the Israelites had their past in Egypt. With our moods, you know, the Israelites are grumpy and grumbling and hungry and fed up. Maybe all of those things come into our lives, well they do in mine anyway. And we have to deal with those things as we go. Isn't that what our Christian lives can be like? Well, here in Exodus, one of the problems is they did have a kind of strange idea about God. Look at verse 3. They said, the Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. What's all that about? Only in the previous chapter, God has said to them, I'm your healer. Here, just a few verses, just a centimeter down the page, they're saying, God's our killer. They kind of got not quite the right idea about God, have they, in their heads? And God's response to that is not to blast them, but to teach them. Verse 4 talks about instructions. Talks about a test. Says, I'm going to test the Israelites. Actually, God says the same thing in chapter 15. They're going to be tested. This journey, this desert, will involve a test. What do you think about tests? Now, tests can be one of two at least things, can't they? Driving tests. What do you do on your driving tests? Well, you're proving that you've learnt to drive, haven't you? The test's there to establish that you've learnt something. You know, it's there how a good teacher will use a test, not to frighten you, not to give you a bad time, but to show you that actually you've learnt, you can do it. You've learnt something. It's got into you. You're like in the driving test. You take the test to show that the skills you've got, you know, in your head that you had with the instructor saying it, so you can actually do now. That's one kind of test. Another kind of test is the kind that I believe engineers do. There's a few engineers here, but engineers, don't you do things with materials and things so that you actually test them until they break? Is that right? You know, to see how much they can take, and you break them deliberately. That's not the kind of test that God is into. God is into the test we're talking about here. He's not giving them as hard a time and see if they can break, but actually, let's see how they can learn, how much they've learned, how much they've really got hold of, to teach them. So on the journey, they learn about God. And that's key for us on our journeys too. They also live with God. And they, thirdly, trust in God. And I want us to, in the little bit of time we have left, to look at those three areas through these stories. They're learning about God on the journey. You see, they need to get their thinking straight about God, don't they? Look at how strange their thinking is in verse 3. As I said, they think that God was going to kill them in Egypt. That's a very strange view of things, isn't it? It's almost as if they're saying, you know, we wish we'd never slaughtered that lamb. You know, we don't know why we bothered to kill that lamb and put the blood over. We wish we'd been judged with the Egyptians back in Egypt. The whole thing's a complete waste of time. God could have killed us there. He's going to kill us in the desert. I mean, what kind of idea do they have about God there? They're kind of forgetting a few quite key things, aren't they, about him. And then they think about all these pots of meat that they had in Egypt. That's kind of warping their thinking. And then they turn around to Moses and they say to Moses, you brought us out of Egypt. They moan against Moses. And they, you may have noticed in the passage, on more than one occasion, they're saying, Moses, it's your fault. You did it. We're moaning about you. You see, the God doesn't get a mention here. They're kind of saying, well, they're about God, but Moses, it's all down to you. The Lord is completely absent from their thinking, totally. Because they're just absorbed by hunger and desert. And they haven't yet learnt what it means to travel with God, have they? And sometimes we can find ourselves in those kind of situations. What does God do? Well, he responds. He helps Moses to teach them. As I say, he doesn't blast them. He responds very graciously. Verse 6. Moses and Aaron tell the Israelites that it was the Lord who brought you out. God had done something for you. It wasn't us. It was God. God was at work. Verse 7. Here they're told that you will see God's glory. It's God. It's not us. It's God that you're grumbling about, and you will see just something more of who this God is who's leading you. And so in verse 10, they see the glory of God. While Aaron was speaking, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of God appearing in the cloud. Where is the glory of God appearing? Where is it? In the cloud. Where is the cloud? In the sky, yeah. Towards the desert. So what are they learning? God's in the desert with them, isn't he? That's where he is. And more than that, he's going to promise food to them. He says, verse 12, I am the Lord your God, and by the way, I'm going to give you more food than pots of meat that you had in Egypt. I'm going to give you meat in the evening and bread in the morning. And as we read in the story, a flock of quails, and apparently this happens in this area, in this part of the world, which some people think is not far from the Gulf of Aqaba, if those of us have been to Aqaba, just over there in the desert, sometimes my migratory birds, whole flocks of them will come over and they'll be tired in the night and they'll just flop down, and the kind of bird that it is, they don't get off the ground very easily, and if they flop down in the middle of a camp of about a million people, then they're dead meat, aren't they? Well, they're living meat when they arrive, but you know how it is. And that's what happens. And amazing, God uses this natural phenomenon, this thing about God's plans, what Carol was talking about earlier, exemplified here in this passage on three occasions. God uses something that's already prepared, already in the natural order of things, and makes it available to them. And in the morning they get up and there's this stuff that goes with the frost that is also, I don't know its name, but there is also a substance that is secreted by certain aphids and algae and so on, and there is this kind of this material, this white stuff that you can eat. Now again, it's occasionally known. I mean, the miracle is that it came morning after morning after morning after morning. So here is God taking something in the natural world and in the timing and in the provision of it gives them this miracle, this food that they're able to eat. What can we learn from this? Do we need our thinking about God straightened out on the journey? Well, I think we do, don't we? I know I do on my journey. Do we sometimes have false ideas about God's intentions? Do we sometimes get to think with the Israelites that God's going to kill us, he's going to blast us, you know, he's not for us, when the Bible tells us very clearly that's not the case, he is for us? Do you sometimes refuse to take, if you like, issue with God, but rather blame the leaders of the church or the person who shared that thing with you or whatever it was? Do you find yourself doing it? Do you sometimes wish maybe even that you'd never become a Christian in the first place? Because that's what those Israelites were saying. Wish we'd stayed in Egypt. Well, all of those things can sometimes come into our lives and we need our thinking about God straightened out. We need to realize that God is with us in the desert, and sometimes deserts can help us straighten our thinking out about God. And if you want to talk and pray with somebody about that, then there are people, there's a prayer team here, isn't there? Yeah, who'd be willing to pray with you. Let's read on and see what happens next. Verse 15. What is it, they said, because they did not know what it was. And the word, what is it, is the Hebrew manna. That's where we get, it means, what is it? Manna is, what is it? Kind of word, okay? Moses said, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent. The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots, and so began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. So they saved it until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? That you there is plural. He's referring to the whole people. Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where he is on the seventh day. No one is to go out. So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel call the bread manna. It was like coriander seed. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt. So Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come. As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. That's the Ark of the Covenant, the place where God's presence was to be kind of symbolized. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. An omer is one-tenth of an ephah. Won't explain that. Not got time. It's not particularly useful anyway to know what an omer is. But anyway, it's a measure of manna or of stuff. So, God provides them with manna. Comes down every day. What are they learning? They're learning about living with God, aren't they? Because it's not just that he provides for them. The way they're to deal with this stuff teaches them about what it is to live as God's people, dependent upon him. What are they going to learn from this? Not time for interaction. I was going to ask you to interact. But they'd have to learn that God's going to give them enough for what they need. And they're going to have to trust God. He gives us enough. You get too much, it'll go off and smell. I don't know, maybe sometimes it's like that with possessions, isn't it? It is possible to have so much that they go off and stink. Stink up your life, ruin your witness, just too much stuff. Is that possible? Should we be living our lives with God as we've got enough, that's enough? That's what these people were learning day by day in the matter of their food. What else did they learn? They had to learn that there was a rhythm of life in which they needed to take time to be with God. So this Sabbath idea, interesting, this comes before the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments don't come till Exodus 20. Here God's saying, even before then, every week, here's a reminder, take a day to be with me. Make of that what you like. But part of the rhythm of living with God is that we make time for him. Isn't it? It's amazing, isn't it? They still don't take any notice. Did you notice in the passage? You know, whether it was, you know, getting too much, it went bad, or going out on the following day, the Israelites are a bit slow to learn. But, you know, they learn eventually. And there's something in us, isn't there, that kind of doesn't like this idea of only having enough or just trusting God for stuff. You know, we like to kind of do things for ourselves a bit maybe. And the third thing is that they have to remember God's provision
in the future. God says to them, look, this manna, I want you to keep some. And I want you to keep it as a reminder of this mighty act that God has done for you. So they're learning something there, that it's important to remember God's mighty acts. It's important that, in living with God, living enough for the need, enough from God for our needs. That's about trust, isn't it? Giving time to God in the rhythm of life. How you use Sunday is up to you, but you know, whether it's about Sunday or whatever, I'll let you decide. But this idea of time for God is terribly important, isn't it, in living with Him? And we need to remember God's provision, God's mighty acts. We remember the mighty acts of God, don't we, when we come together and sing those songs. I was feeling a bit low this morning. The first couple of songs really lifted my heart because I was singing stuff that's true about God. And I found myself, as I sing it, starting to not just believe it, but kind of feel it again. It's remembering God's mighty act. As we take communion, bread and wine, we remember Jesus' mighty act, God's mighty act on the cross. So then, we need to travel with God, to learn from Him. We need to live with Him. And then the third thing we need to do, which we won't have time to, but you can read it when you get home, in chapter 17, we need to trust in God when the situation is really, really tough. Because they go on and they have no water at all. None. Not bitter water this time, but just no water. And they get very upset about it. And they really start moaning and groaning again. And God, in His gracious love and mercy, provides them with a constant supply, or a massive supply of water. And there's a warning in this third story, because it happened twice. It happens here in Exodus 17. But they came back later on in the journey, it seems, to the same place in Numbers 20. And they went through exactly the same thing again. And the New Testament looks back to that in Hebrews 4 and the Old Testament in Psalm 95. And God is angry with the people when they come back the second time. Not here, but the second time when they come back. And they still haven't learned, and they still aren't able to trust God. And their genuine doubts have now turned to actual unbelief. And the lesson we need to learn about trusting God in severe circumstances, I believe, is this. Is that we need to beware of coming back to the same issues in our lives. We need to make progress, don't we? If we're coming back to the same things, the same contentions, the same controversies about God, we need to beware that those things don't turn into unbelief. And that's a warning to us. So we're rescued for relationship on the journey. On the journey, we need to be learners, open to learn about God, keeping our hearts in tune with His truth. How do we do that? We do it through Scripture, we do it through the Holy Spirit, and we do it through the Christian community. We need to be people who live with God, with His provision, time with Him, trusting Him, remembering His great acts, and we need to trust God when things get tough, and we need to beware of reverting to past habits or sins that, in a sense, sinful patterns that have been dealt with or should have been dealt with, but keep coming up again and again in our lives.